welcome to the 324th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
That's right, he's back from vacation, and we are glad to have him. We're going to be talking about Apple's HomeKit / smart home strategy. Also, we're going to be talking about a brand new standard for industrial or smart building IoT that you're going to want to learn about. We've got new chips for the IoT from Qualcomm. Google's killing some of its AR tools, and we're not thrilled with it. We've got an update on some Helium stuff, and I tried out the new NanoLeaf Elements lights, and I like them. So we're going to talk about those as well. Plus, our guest this week is Paulus Schautzen, creator of Home Assistant. And y'all are going to want to stay tuned for him because he tells us about some upcoming products, a bit about how Home Assistant's going to work with Matter, and more. And we're also going to hear from our sponsor, B-Squared. But first, let's take a break and welcome a new sponsor to the show. This week's sponsor is Edge Impulse. Join Edge Impulse Imagine. This is going to be a new event on the latest innovations in embedded machine learning for the real world. This will take place September 29th through October 1st. And Edge Impulse Imagine will feature interviews with and talks by industry leaders and pioneers, as well as expert-led workshops on building next-generation ML solutions. You can register now at edgeimpulse.com/imagine. I am so going to hit that up because we all know I love myself some machine learning at the edge. Okay, Kevin, I feel like we should do one thing before we get into Apple strategy, and don't groan, but I feel like we should address the Amazon Sidewalk stuff just a little bit because I know, don't hate me.
I'm kidding.
I know, but
it does need to be addressed because I know you wrote a post while I was away.
And we talked about it last week on the show.
Yes. And I think as somebody who read your post, you know, later, we didn't talk about it or anything because I was away. I came away with a takeaway. You're just expressing it's fine if you want to opt out. And here are the reasons that would make sense to opt out, you know. But everybody, not everybody, but a large number of people have commented and it took it the wrong way. Like you're saying to not opt out. And that's not at all what I took away.
Yeah. So, I mean, we also saw some additional like common concerns. So the big, if I'm summing up the main beef that people have, it's that Amazon opted people in without asking them. And there's a lot of like this idea of bandwidth theft, which unless you're on a metered plan, I don't think you should worry too much about. It's not a lot of bandwidth. But the idea of Amazon getting something for nothing really bothers people.
Yes.
So my hope is Amazon actually rewards people in some way for participating, not just because, like, I'm doing it because I'm an altruistic IoT networking fan, right? Like, I really want to have a low-power IoT network that works. And that is accessible for developers. And, you know, there are others out there. And that's the other thing that we saw. We saw lots of people like, hey, why don't they work with Helium? Why don't they work with some of the other ideas? Sorry. Why don't they work with some of the other networks out there? Two things. Amazon Sidewalk is using a LoRa chip, but they're not compatible with all of the LoRa devices out there. So that's one. So your Helium and Amazon for now, and probably, I won't say forever because that's a long time, but not for any time soon, are not going to work together. I think the other networks are great. I want them to succeed, but like right now, Helium has a scaling problem. You can't buy enough hotspots to cover it. Amazon is going to go live with millions of devices on day one, which was yesterday.
Probably tens, if not more than 100 million.
Yeah. And yeah. Helium has 53,000 hotspots.
It would have 53,001 if the one I ordered, not from Helium, because they don't sell them anymore, came in. But it just got pushed back again till later this month.
Yeah.
That's the challenge. Amazon doesn't have that challenge. It already has a footprint in however many millions of homes. So from their perspective, what's the easiest way to quote-unquote build or light up a I'll call it nationwide low power network for IoT, is to opt everybody in. I don't agree with that. Obviously, yeah, I've talked about this many times, but from their perspective, that's the easiest way to light it up and then let people who don't want in get out. And they're still going to have great coverage, I'm sure. People are missing the point. It's your home. It's your internet connection, and it's your choice. Turn it off and let it die. Why all this
vitriol.
Agitation? Yeah. Yeah. Again, people misread it as you were like, I don't want to say shilling, even though one person did say that.
Oh, many people said that.
Well, whatever. Putting it as if it's a good idea to opt in. You know, it's still a personal choice. And that goes with everything we talk about here on this show.
Yes. Like, I don't have inside cameras. You might. That's okay. Yeah. Anyway. And so just to be clear, I don't make any money at all from Amazon, and I don't think they've ever sponsored the show or anything. So there's no money changing hands.
No, absolutely not. And just to be also transparent, I'm opting out.
Yes, Kevin's opting out, and I'm not firing him.
Yeah. Frankly, here's the thing, I'm not happy that they opted everybody in, but so I'm opting out. And the reason I'm opting out is because I don't have any devices in Amazon's playground that would take advantage, give me any benefit. If I did, then I probably would have stayed in. But I don't, so I made my choice.
Yeah, and maybe you'll buy some sort of device and it will use that, and you'll be like, oh, now I get it.
Because now I get a network.
The other thing is, eventually, there will be devices on this network, and you will benefit on your own from having it.
Right.
So, okay. Enough about that. Let's talk about another A-named company, notably Apple. We sat through the very long WWDC.
2 hours. 2 hours. Just for the keynote.
Yeah. And we should also say we're recording this on Wednesday morning. Thursday, they have a HomeKit and Matter. What is the word I'm looking for? Panel?
Breakout session or whatever
session.
For developers.
Yeah. Yes.
Sessions, yes.
They have a session on that. So we don't know what we're going to learn there. But what we do know is, Kevin, you want to talk about it? It's so much. It's actually not that much.
Well, okay. So I wrote it up, and what I wrote up may not seem like a lot. Maybe it does, but there's even more, quite honestly. So instead of talking about it for an hour, I'll just go through some of the high level things. First and foremost, only because we've been getting questions about it a lot. The upcoming iOS 15 software update, which will be, it's already available for developer preview. It will be a public beta next month. I will be in on that public beta. I don't feel like paying them $100 a year to get the developer stuff early. It will bring Matter support. And that was like huge, even though it wasn't like the first thing they talked about. I think it's huge because they're like not being as vague as other companies, or other companies not even mentioning Matter yet. Like, has Amazon said anything about Matter?
Amazon hasn't said anything about Matter. Oh, by the way, y'all.
It just doesn't matter. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Matter is the new name for Project Connected Home over IP, which is the interoperability standard we've been talking about for the last, like, year and a half. Okay,
yes.
Carry on.
Sorry about that. Yes, no. We have new listeners that are like, what about Project Chip? yes, so that's coming in iOS 15. I got some information talking to a few people. I find this interesting. It does not appear that Matter devices will have to be certified as HomeKit devices to work in the Apple Home app. And that's brand new, obviously,
yes.
Because you have to be HomeKit certified to be a HomeKit device. So that may change, but I don't think it will. The goal of Matter, if you're like brand new into the show, is to make easier connections of devices, smart home devices, IoT devices, across multiple platforms. So you could, in theory, use a Google speaker with some Apple sensors that are HomeKit sensors, etc. So that's why it's a big deal across ecosystems. So, what else?
About Siri?
Siri. So, they talked about Siri, and they mentioned on-device intelligence a couple of times. You caught that, right?
Yeah, I thought that was really. I was like, "Ooh, is that local?" Is Siri going local?
It is. So they even showed a demo, iOS 15 demo, of somebody using Siri on an iPhone where they basically didn't control their smart home, but they did control the phone. So they're like, you know, what's the weather? What's this? Turn on airplane mode, which it did, no problem. And up till that point, you know, they had a connection to the cloud. Now in airplane mode, they kept going, well, what's my calendar? What's my next event? What's this? What's that? Show me this. And it all still worked. So yes, Siri is going to localized, local state, I'll call it. Now, I would have loved to have seen some demonstration about the smart home and how Siri's going to work that way. But then I thought about it. To be a HomeKit device, you have to work, you have to have local support anyway. So my guess is it will still work locally in the smart home as well.
Like on your HomePod?
Well, that's the thing. So the processing, the on-device processing would then go through a HomePod or a plugged-in iPad or an Apple TV where you've got some really bulky, I mean, in terms of compute power, chips to handle the local natural language processing and then tap into HomeKit and say, this was what was said, so this is what you do to this device. Mm-hmm. So this is good because from a privacy standpoint, people want more local control.
Yes.
Yes. If you're in the iOS world, you can have that.
Well, Google's doing a lot with local control too.
Google's doing a lot, but I haven't seen end results yet. I mean, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong.
No, you're right. The local SDK, it's still in beta. Okay. Right. All right, Google, get moving.
Yeah, well, we were watching this event simultaneously from our homes and chatting. And I think this is where I said Apple is actually out Googling Google in this regard.
It really is. Yes. And we weren't watching simultaneously, by the way, on the new FaceTime features. Ha ha. Because I am not part of the Apple ecosystem entirely.
Yet.
Okay. Now, here comes some exciting things. They also mentioned something regarding locks. And I think this is going to be possibly the basis, I don't know, for the standard that I wrote about a couple weeks ago that the Connectivity Standards Alliance is building with Google, Apple, Yale, and
ASSA ABLOY.
ASSA ABLOY. Sorry, not Yale. They make Yale for smart locks. And so, Kevin, you want to tell us what Apple announced? Because this is a big deal, actually, for the lock world.
Yeah, so they didn't announce any new lock products. They announced new lock functionality in the HomeKit world. And basically, they are using either your iPhone or your Apple Watch can be a key to your home, just like it can. Either of those can be a car key for your new BMW, and then other models are coming soon. They announced that part last year. So they're adding home keys basically to your Apple Wallet, which is on the secure enclave of whatever iOS device you have. I wasn't sure if they were using ultra wideband for this, but it appears they're using NFC. And that's really good because that means all the older supported iPhones with an NFC chip, but not with an ultra wideband chip, will be able to unlock smart locks. Same with the Apple Watch, because it has NFC for mobile payments. So that's good. You've just expanded the potential user base by a ton by not using ultra-wideband. And really, you don't need ultra-wideband for this. NFC is fine.
So will I have to buy a new lock to use this?
That's going to be the unfortunate part. It's going to depend on if your lock currently has an NFC chip, which I don't think many do. Yeah. I mean, I can't think of a one, but I'm sure there are some out there, but I don't any recognizable ones? No. So, okay. Yeah. So you know what that means. I'm so glad I did not change out my Nest by Yale as I transitioned to HomeKit, because now I can wait for the NFC lock.
Yes. This holiday is going to be a big season for locks, I bet.
It is. Not just locks, though, because in a surprising move, but a welcome one, Apple has opened up Siri support on HomeKit accessories, meaning third-party devices can integrate Siri into their devices. And the first one will be Ecobee. And even better, because Ecobee put out a news release not long after the event, it's existing Ecobee smart thermostats that have the Madam A integration, because it's got the speaker and the microphone there. Mm-hmm. They're going to get a firmware upgrade, and they're going to have Siri with that, and then all new ones going forward as well.
Woo! That is actually really good. Yeah, I have an Ecobee too. If I don't have HomeKit, but yes.
I have HomeKit, but I don't have the Ecobee with the mic and the
speaker. Oh, maybe I should rip that off the wall and send
it. Let's trade. Yes. So, but that's good. And that really opens up the world to putting Siri in anything, just like they do with Google Assistant and Madam A. So that's big.
That is big. Yay.
And speaking of big, how about Apple TV, which you wouldn't normally think of as a smart home bit, but it is, because with HomeKit devices, you can see like automations and such. You can fire those off from your Apple TV. You can also, in fact, I have this feature. If you have a HomeKit doorbell and somebody rings the doorbell and you're watching TV, the feed pops up. But it's only one feed today. Now you're going to have multiple feeds. They showed 4 HomeKit cameras on a single Apple TV. It looks sweet. I guess if you just want to sit around and scan your property, your estate, you can do this from there.
Oh, yes.
Yes, I do that all the time. I sit in the backyard and just, you know, when the drone is down, I use the TV to scan.
I pop my monocle in and I stare at the TV.
Yes, yes. And in addition, and I thought this was really neat, if you're looking at a camera for a particular area of your home, maybe it's backyard. So you've got the backyard camera, you're viewing on your living room TV, for example. Any devices that are also attached to the backyard room, it's going to intelligently pop up so that you can see maybe the temperature outside, or maybe you've got outside lights that are not on and you want to flip those on. So it's going to surface contextually devices for whatever area you're viewing.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a lot.
Yeah, and not yet. The home keys are a big deal.
They are. And I would say you came away feeling like Apple HomeKit has kind of really, this is a big deal for them. It moves them up quite a bit.
So my take is that I've kind of been blah on HomeKit from the beginning because it just didn't do enough. There wasn't enough devices, right? So now, as I transition, and I'm doing that because it can do more via software updates, and now they're going to have Thread support, which I'm already using on the HomePod Mini and some Eve Thread devices. Now I kind of feel like it's the time to really be excited because of all this opening up to add Siri to other devices now, the fact that Matter devices probably won't need to be HomeKit devices. Now, my two main concerns are gone. You're going to have a wide breadth of accessories, whether they're HomeKit or non-HomeKit, to use in a HomeKit home. You've got the Matter support. You've got Thread support already, which I'm taking advantage of and loving. And you're getting increased privacy, and that's, I'm paying a little extra for the iCloud storage, which gives me HomeKit secure video on my cameras. So now it's almost like, well, gee, now what's to complain about?
Indeed. We'll find something.
Oh, I know, but I can't, I'm feeling much better about it than I used to. Yes.
Excellent. All right. And I didn't mention this, but we're also, speaking of HomeKit, we're going to be talking about the EU making a decision about the digital assistants, because that came out this week and it's a pretty big deal.
From a privacy standpoint, among other things.
Okay, so the Commission, the EU, so this is most of Europe. Sorry, most. Brexit. They launched a report into the consumer IoT, and today they published some of their findings, and they found 4 things that really upset them. And we'll just run down those really fast and talk about what we think, you know, is what we think of them. So first concern they had was an attempt to restrict the number of voice assistant accessible on smart devices. So if you are making an Ecobee thermostat for Madam A's ecosystem, you may not be able to put HomeKit on it or Siri on it. This upsets them. But that is changing.
As we just said, yes.
So it seems like now Amazon does make a specialized chip that will put Madam A easily on a device, but you don't have to use that to get certified. So, you know, if you use it, it's because you don't have the developer. You don't want to associate with the developer costs, and that's fine.
And there are devices, a particularly good example is Sonos. The Sonos One speakers originally came with Madam A and then later got Google Assistant. You could configure to use one or the other. You can't use both at the same time, obviously, but you could use one or the other. So maybe other vendors will take that approach.
Maybe. And it's possible that they're like, hey, you should be, maybe the EU's upset because you can't do both at the same time. I don't
know. Well, the EU should try using two different speakers at the same time to see how of a cluster that is.
There you go. So their second concern is that the voice assistant providers could take over the direct relationship with users because users are using it to control their other devices and don't often use the app, which is totally true. I almost never open the Lutron app unless I'm adding more Lutron bits.
And do you happen to get any ads for non-Amazon things on your Echo devices?
No.
And do you get a lot of those annoying ads?
I do. It drives me bonkers.
Yeah. So plus one to the EU on this.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you there. Well, yes and no. I mean, I don't actually want to have a direct relationship with every single device I own. That would be too much. So I kind of feel like the Amazon ads are really annoying. I'm not going to say that. Mm-hmm. But I can also switch. And, but I do want to kind of kill the apps of the other people. And I think that's actually going to happen if you're not really amazing with things like Matter, just so you know.
Yeah.
So there's that. Now, if they create something like an app store that like says you can only buy a subscription through Madame A or Google, that's a different situation.
Right, like, right.
So yeah, a lot of things to keep an eye on, but nothing particularly egregious there, I feel. Okay. Third, voice assistants collect an enormous amount of data.
No.
Did you know that?
Say it isn't so.
And they're saying having access to data gives big advantages as the voice assistants accumulate it. I think, yes, they do have a lot of access to data. What I think is more problematic is that Amazon in particular uses its power to say, if you don't share your device data with us, we're not going to sell you on Amazon, right?
Right. That's the bigger issue, I think, too. And to be clear, Apple actually doesn't get the data.
Right. In some, if you're a big enough provider of a smart home device, you don't share your data with Amazon. You negotiate with Amazon. You're like, I see you. I call your bluff. Don't sell my product in your store and see what happens.
Exactly.
But I do think that's an area to look at. Finally, the EU is upset about limited interoperability between products and services from companies that are different.
Did they wake up in 2008?
Well, you know, we're still in this era, but I will say Matter is going to help with that. It's not going to help across all classes of devices. And we've been complaining about this, yes, since like 2000 and I'm going to say 11, really. That's when I bought my first Wemo.
Yeah.
Which was, I think, my first real smart home.
2010, device. I was doing Insteon stuff. So that was my earliest.
Yeah. But that was all the proprietary radios anyway. I mean,
we won't go into that. It was, everything was proprietary back then for the most part. At least we're using ubiquitous wireless standards at the application level. We're not there yet, but that's what Matter solves at the application level.
Yeah. So basically the EU is saying, hey, this is our statement and come tell us what you think and eventually we'll make some rules. So that's where we are on that. And I just wanted to let y'all know because it's important. Now let's talk about another innovation from Europe. And this one is for scalable, highly dense industrial or building IoT networks. This is a lot to explain, but we can do it. All right.
We can do it.
There is a company in Finland called Wirepass. I really like them. I've written about them twice. They have been developing a standard using 1.9 gigahertz spectrum. It is the DECT 2020 standard.
The old cordless telecoms.
Exactly.
Yeah. I was like, we had a DECT phone. Boy, we could go 10 feet further from the house to talk on our cordless phone.
So Wirepass has built a mesh networking protocol that is low power, that is highly dense. And what do I mean by highly dense? I mean that you can run a million nodes, so a million little individual pieces in a 1 kilometer space with those things sending a packet every 2 hours.
Parking sensors.
They've also shown like 5,000 sensors running in like a 1 meter space. This is very dense. This is important, though, for any sort of thing where you're going to, any sort of like a building or a factory floor where you're going to have the nodes might be people, the sensors that you're running. It might be the individual handset devices that the people you're relying on carry. It's a lot.
Office chairs.
office chairs.
Who's at their desk? Who's in this conference room? Or is the conference room available? Yeah.
Is it hot? Is it cold? All of that can run on these. It can be battery powered. So the big news is they're making this part of the 5G standard. Actually, there's two pieces of news. One is the 5G standard news. The other is that Silicon Labs is making chips that use the WirePass DEC 2020 world. Well, they use the WirePass standard over Bluetooth. So Slab is now making Bluetooth chips that will use this standard. So now you can have a highly dense Bluetooth network in your building. The other news is that they're working with the ITU, the International Telecommunication Union, which has oversight over 5G. I know 3GPP has oversight over 5G, but there is the other side of 5G that the ITU has. This is so confusing. But the bottom line is you're going to be able to run the same highly dense WirePass protocol on NB-IoT or LTE Cat M whatever.
Yes, your flavor of the month.
Whatever LTE flavor you want. So basically what we're talking about is bringing highly dense networks to buildings and factory settings on your like private networks.
Yeah, so this is far less for say a consumer, but this would be great for industrial, for office buildings, maybe even for
smart city
agriculture.
Oh, well, yeah, maybe. Depends on how far you could go. Bluetooth obviously is not great for agriculture, but NB-IoT would be. So sure.
Exactly.
Bring it.
You could measure the soil moisture at each individual corn stalk.
Woo!
Out here, that's a thing where I live. So.
Oh, okay. I'm like, I guess they do. Yeah, they do it for vines and vineyards.
Right, right.
Expensive crops. Okay. Now, speaking of industrial IoT, let's talk about Qualcomm. Qualcomm has launched a bunch of new modems and new purpose-built SoCs for the IoT. They're using the relatively new Qualcomm 315 5G IoT modem. I know, that's a lot. But basically, 3 weeks ago, Qualcomm said, hey, you know what? We're launching this brand new modem for industrial IoT. What makes it special is that it's only going to speak 5G. So this, it'll speak LTE, but it's not speaking LTE as its first language. It will fall back to LTE. This allows it to be more future-proof, one. Two, it allows it to consume less power. And three, it's able to be a lot more rugged for industrial settings because you've got a smaller footprint and it's produces less heat. So All very good things.
So this would actually be good for people, companies designing IoT modules that currently they want to either sell or use LTE on them.
Yeah, and they have.
But eventually future-proof for 5G, this same chip will work.
Yes, and they have got a ton of the big companies that are making the gateway devices for industrial IoT. They already planning to, they're already sampling it and they're going to design it in. So that's big. So what Qualcomm has done is combined that rugged, lower power sucking, smaller 315 IoT 5G modem with different application processors, different Wi-Fi radios, different other radios.
SoCs, basically.
Yeah, they're making SoCs. So some of the SoCs have neural networks plus Wi-Fi 6. Some of them have Wi-Fi 6E and a neural network. Some of them have, you know, more compute cores on them. So there's six of them. We're not going to go into all of them, but it's a big deal. Qualcomm's really stepping up in this space, and I am very excited to see it. Okay, now it's time for some news bits.
Oh, I have one.
Hit me.
Okay. I don't know if you use this on your Android phone, but about 2 years ago, Google came out with an app called Measure. And Measure is basically uses like, it's an AR app to measure things, items around your house. Very clever use. Apple has the same or similar app, etc. And Apple was talking about AR quite a bit this week. Ironically, Google isn't talking about AR this week. And in fact, the Measure app is dead, basically. It will not have any more future updates. If you have it on your phone now, you can continue to use it, but it will not be updated. And if you uninstall it, you're not likely going to be able to get it back. So don't get rid of it.
Oh,
why would they do this?
It's Google. They're just like, fling it at the wall.
Why?
They'll come back with it. All right.
I guess.
Other things. This is for all the Helium lovers out there. Actually, it's for anybody who wants to use a LoRa network to track something. Helium is working with a company called Abe Way. And Abeway is building trackers and buzzers and other things for the Helium network. And I always get questions. Helium is a low power wide area network that runs over, well, LoRaWAN. Basically, people are like, hey, does Helium have any customers? Because people right now are like very excited about making money mining or serving as coverage points on the network and thus getting their tokens and then trading those tokens for dollars.
You want to use the network too.
Yeah. So people use the network. Lime is actually their big Keystone customer, which is maybe not great since nobody's been using scooters, but
I don't know. I saw tons of Lime scooters in DC on my trip last week.
Oh, okay. Well, good. So that is one of their customers. At Abeway is now another one. And the fun thing is if you have a Helium device and you're like, hey, I want to use this just for fun to see what I'm missing out on, you can buy some of these yourself. They're very expensive. These are not designed for consumer use, really, but you can buy a micro tracker for $90, a smart badge for $123. And then there's some industrial trackers for $160 and a compact tracker for $142.
Yeah, I don't need to use it that much.
No, but this is, I just want to let people know that it's out there if they want to play.
I totally agree. Totally agree. You know, they actually have like an evaluation kit too, where you can pick a couple different things. I think it's $126.59. I'm looking at it and yeah.
Yeah, you can wander around and check out the coverage.
Yep.
Okay. And now let's talk about a new device that I have liked.
Oh, she loves it.
I do. I love these. They're not... So these are the Nanoleaf's new Elements lights. Nanoleaf makes light panels, LED light panels. We've talked about them a lot on the show. They've been on our gift guide before.
They use thread.
They use, actually, so let's talk about that.
Let's.
So the new Nanoleaf lights are basically faux wood, faux blonde wood covered. They look like Denmark on a light panel. If IKEA had come out with them, I would not have been surprised. I know IKEA is not Danish. They're Swedish. I love them. They work. They're actually better designed than the earlier versions of the Nanoleafs. They don't have the dark corners. They also have a nicer mounting fixture that you would find on the Shapes, which are the, I guess, the generation before this. There were the Shapes and the hexagons and the Shapes and the
right.
triangles.
And these are hexagons.
Oh, yeah. These are hexagons.
Oh, yeah. They love their wood and their hexagons.
So these are expensive. A starter kit, which is going to contain 7 panels and the like controller plus the... Well, the controller now contains the rhythm module, so it can kind of dance along with your music. This
right,
is all.
It's got the microphone in there.
Yeah, this is going to cost you $299.99. So that's $300.
It's not going to cost me that because I'm not spending that much. But
yes, and
but.
If don't think of these as lights. You have to think of them as like ambiance, art, whatever. This is not these. Each panel gives 22 lumens. It is not enough to see by, and unlike other Nanoleaf panels, these are only going to be white tunable. The wood ones are all about like natural white, mm-hmm. soothing light.
The light frequencies of nature.
Exactly.
Hmm.
So
is the connector different or the same as the older?
The connectors are the same as the older hexagons, or sorry, as the Shapes. So the back connectors for the panels that you use to connect them and thus get them power are the same. And you can actually connect the other panels in there, but they're not going to light up in the colors if they're in this setup.
You'd have to have a separate controller, separate power. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of a little bit of a bummer. So about thread.
About thread, yes. Because I was curious because I knew most of Nanoleaf products now support thread, but you need a board or a router, and I don't think you have one, do you?
So here's what's going to happen with this. These, initially, they said that these are Wi-Fi only, and they are 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi, just so you know.
That's fine.
They might be a little painful to set up on a mesh network if you can't turn your mesh 5 gigahertz off. But I talked to their product manager, Nathan Dick, on a panel I did for Silicon Labs on Matter, and he mentioned that these will act as a Thread border router. They just don't do it today. So,
and I'm not surprised, and I'll tell you why.
Tell me why.
They have the Wi-Fi connection to get data from the Thread Mesh Network, device data, to your internet connection. Mm-hmm. And they're always plugged in.
Yes, exactly.
That's the key right there.
Yes. So it will have, so eventually, yes, this will be a Thread border router right here in my very own home. Working with any Thread Matter-based Thread whatevers, hopefully. Now, this isn't Matter certified because that doesn't exist yet. But
Right.
So,
but if you have a Thread network and you need another border router, maybe one at each end of the house, for example, and you want some ambiance, that's another benefit. Now
you're like, ooh, you've got your Apple 4K TV, your HomePods. Those aren't enough for you. How big is your house?
You know what? The problem is I only have one HomePod mini, which is my border router. And I have one Apple TV, the newest one. I sent the review unit back, but I bought my own. I ordered it even before the review. They're both in the same room. So I'm not spreading those border routers out.
Ah, I see where we're at. Well, maybe for the holidays this year, you'll find yourself in possession of another Thread border router. Okay. Questions?
No, I was going to say one of the Eve products is not a border router, but it is a router. So it can relay the signal a little bit more. That's the always plugged in connected smart plug.
Yes, that is true.
Yeah, so that's how I've expanded everything so far.
And each Thread border router supports 50 devices, so you may not need it for a little bit, right?
Yeah, not for another month or so.
There you go. Okay. All right. Well, that concludes the news portion of the show. Now let's go to the Internet of Things podcast hotline, which this week is brought to you by Very. Are you looking for an IoT development firm that has been there, done that? Very's award-winning team of senior engineers, designers, and data scientists will work with you to get your biggest IoT hardware and software projects fully operational. You can learn more at www.verypossible.com. This week on the hotline... Oh, wait, I haven't told you anything about the hotline. That's terrible of me. All right, first up, if you would like for us to answer your question on the hotline, give us a call at 512-623-7424. And if you do that, you'll be entered to win the smart speaker of your choice. Yay!
One of them's a border router.
And one of them's a Thread border router. And one of them might be, we just don't know. Actually, two of them might be, and we just don't know. Okay. There you go. We'll find out on the Amazon front. The Google stuff is going to be Matter support. And I bet there's a Thread in the Nest Audio. I don't know.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. We're going to look into that. This week's hotline comes to us. Actually, this is an unusual one because we are basically publishing a plea for more security in Moen Flow products. So,
which more security is always a valid request.
Yes. And listen to this poor man. He has been waiting for this for a while.
Hi, Stacy. This is Thomas Munn, an internet security expert. My issue is last year, you may remember, or the year before last year, I actually talked about Moen not having two-factor on their Flow system. They said that they would do it, and so I followed up recently because I noticed there's still no two-factor. So if you can talk to those people and tell them that they really need to get two-factor on their system 1 year later after having said they would do it, that would be awesome.
Thomas, we hear your plea. Moen, get on it, especially since you said you would do it. And I would say Thomas may be, as like many security experts, he may be like, you know, a little paranoid about things. But I cannot fault him on this one because some of the Moen products actually are allowed to control the water flow in your house.
That could be a problem if you get hacked.
Yeah. So maybe not everything needs two-factor in the smart home. Like, I'm not super worried about someone turning my light bulbs on and off.
I'm all for 2FA on everything, quite honestly, because you never know when an exploit could morph into something beyond what you think they could do, right? May not be limited. So, but I would say a priority should be on things that control
other things.
Physical, yeah, like water, heat, you know, like what if somebody's taking a shower and somebody hacks in and is able to crank up the temperature of the shower and scald you, burn you, or cause a flood or whatever. Yeah, that's a priority.
Yeah, so I'm with you, Thomas. I'm glad that you're calling for this. If you own one of these products, you know, give them a call and be like, yo, We were listening to Stacy and Kevin tell us that someone could hack into our shower stuff and scald us. Get on this.
Well, yeah. Do you want us to send them there? I don't know, but that's okay.
Well, yeah, okay. No.
Nah, that's okay.
I'm like,
we'll take the heat so you don't have to, literally.
Oh, Kevin, terrible. All right, so that's our public service announcement. We've got more coming up with our guest, who is Paulus Schautzen, the creator of Home Assistant. He's going to be doing a call out to the Matter working group to let him in. So this is a very, very activist show we're doing right now. And remember, if you would like your question answered, give us a call at 512-623-7424. And now stay tuned for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is B-Squared. Hey everyone, we are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is B-Square, and I have Tim Shaw back with us this week. Tim, hello. Can you remind our listeners who B-Square is?
Yeah, thanks, Stacey. B-Square is a system software and services company based in Seattle. We have more than 25 years of experience, and we work with device builders using Windows IoT, Linux, Android, and a few other real-time operating systems, and we're pleased to be sponsoring your podcast. Today, I'd like to talk to you about the newest version of Windows 10 IoT Enterprise coming out in the fall. The official name is Windows 10 IoT Enterprise LTSC 2021. Admittedly, it's a long title, but it's a product that we're excited about here at B-Square. You may have also heard people refer to it as vNext.
Okay. What is the deal with vNext?
Yeah, there's some exciting additions coming. First, they've given the OS a smaller footprint. They are also expanding the silicon support and adding new device lockdown features. Finally, they're also introducing a new feature called eFlow, which stands for Azure IoT Edge for Linux on Windows.
Okay, do you want to expand on that?
Sure. Let's start with smaller footprint. Microsoft is responding to customer feedback to slim down the OS image size. Many IoT devices have limited storage space, so Microsoft has optimized the image, bringing the total footprint down from 15 gigs to 8 gigs. This will provide more on-device storage and potentially reduce bill of materials through smaller storage requirements. Next is expanded silicon support. In addition to supporting the full range of Intel hardware, with this release, Microsoft is also going to be supporting Windows on ARM. And specifically, they are working with NXP hardware for this upcoming release. We know with ARM silicon, we typically see both lower costs and less power consumption. We think there's going to be many that are going to be excited to see ARM support coming from Microsoft.
I'm excited for ARM support coming from Microsoft. So they're paying attention to the footprint and to the silicon. What else is new?
Yeah, Microsoft has a strong commitment to enterprise-grade security, and they continue to expand both device lockdown and branding-related features. With this release, they are also going to be delivering something called Device Update Center, and this is going to provide full control of the way device updates can be deployed, whether from the cloud or on-premises. Here at B-Square, we have solution engineers who can help you customize your operating system to meet your product goals.
And how long will Microsoft support this new version?
Yes, part of the product name has the acronym LTSC. This stands for Long-Term Servicing Channel. With each LTSC release, Microsoft provides a full 10 years of support. And we know this is critical because embedded devices are often deployed in the field for many years. Once this product launches, the 10-year support window will begin.
That's great. Anything else?
Actually, yes. One more thing. Microsoft has also announced Azure IoT Edge for Linux on Windows, also known as eFlow. We'll plan to talk more about that next week.
I can hardly wait. Well, what is the timing on all of this?
Yeah, Microsoft hasn't set a definitive release date yet, but we are expecting it sometime this fall. In the meantime, to learn more, check out bsquare.com/Stacy.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacy Higginbotham, and today's guest is Paulus Schautzen, who is the founder of Home Assistant. Paulus, how are you today?
Hey, Stacey, I'm doing great. Thank you.
Excellent. So I told him this, but he was my backup interview in case of COVID. I was going to have Kevin replace me if I got sick and do this interview. So it's been long time in coming because now I feel much better. I'm vaccinated. So I can interview you and I'm super excited. And I know my audience is too. So let's just start off first with, hey, Home Assistant, why does this exist?
Right. So It exists because when we look at like the Internet of Things landscape, and well, maybe I don't know if everybody knows what Home Assistant is. It's an open source home automation platform. So think of it as a smart things hub, but you do need to do a little bit more effort to actually use it and get started because of the way you have to install it. The reason it exists is because we were looking at I'm the founder. I was looking at like the IoT landscape, and there's just not much out there that allows you to full access to your data. Like many of the IoT systems out there, they will talk to a lot of devices, they will pull in all your data, and then it sits in their systems, and their systems don't always fully allow us to get everything out. And with Home Assistant, there is no such thing as like a data silo or like we protect your data. Like all the data that we store is documented. You can get APIs to pull it out. It's easy to build anything on top. And with Home Assistant, we stay local. Every automation runs local. There's no reliance on any cloud.
We're going to love that because everybody always wants to know, is this local? Can I do everything locally? It's also kind of, I'm going to say it's a little difficult to use. I mean, I have used it. I've downloaded it to a Pi. But talk to us about your audience and how you're, I don't know, maybe trying to make it easier for people to use. Or do you, I mean, you probably don't feel like it's difficult to use. But I mean, is this for mainstream users?
Right. So our audience initially, I mean, we started, I mean, when I started it, I was on my own. It was an open source project. So the interface, how to configure it wasn't that much. User friendliness was not a goal because it was just text files. That way, the people that know how to install a Python application, which is the language it's written in, could use it. But after we grew bigger and bigger and people started working on it full time, we realized like we're building all this cool stuff and it's not accessible to like enough people. Like it's kind of a waste of our effort in a way to just make something super cool and keep it limited to a smaller group. So we've been working a lot in the last few years and making it more accessible and accessible. So we have a great onboarding. We discover almost every device in your house automatically. But we also realized that when we were making things easier, the actual most difficult part right now is still the installation. So right now, to install Home Assistant on a Raspberry Pi, you need to download the Home Assistant image and you need to flash it to a SD card and plug it into your Raspberry Pi. And most people don't even know those words, right? Like, this is super technical.
This is true. This is when I call Kevin and I'm like, Kevin, is this what I'm doing? And he says, yes.
Right. And so we were actually looking at this. And so last year, we decided to launch our own hub. So a device that, you know, has Home Assistant pre-installed so that when you plug it in, pretty much you just go through the onboarding and you can start using it. And this worked great. But this hub was still, I mean, this was our first foray into hardware. Like, I mean, we're all software people. That's how we got into home automation. So yeah, we made it was a very powerful board. It was really targeted at like our super fans. It had like an expensive aluminum case and made it look really good. But of course, the price was also very high. And it didn't speak actually any home automation protocols. So we're actually working on something next that's going to be more affordable. We'll have Zigbee in it, but we'll be Matter compatible. And we're hoping to launch it later this year. And this will really make it more mainstream. But I don't think we're not going to focus on the actual mainstream in a way that like we're not going to try to compete with Philips Hue or IKEA or Amazon or Google, but we are mainly for the people that have used those systems, realize it doesn't do everything they need, or they don't see all their device in it and they want to do more. That's when you do like a step up to a more advanced system. And that's where Home Assistant comes into play.
Got it. And that's a good point. And yes, we were like, wow, this is super powerful, but also it doesn't speak Zigbee or Z-Wave. And we were very confused. This was the Home Assistant Blue device that Kevin reviewed.
Correct.
It. So maybe since I'm the true newbie, I will review your next hardware coming out possibly later this year. And I'll be like, seal of approval for more mainstream. Okay, we're going to get into Matter in a little bit. But first, let's talk about local control because it's super important. But it's also, I like the cloud. The cloud has all this intelligence. It has access to so much more information. So talk to me about how you think about what should be local and what should maybe you can reach out to the cloud for.
So I think everything should be local as much as possible. And I think that as we see devices getting more and more powerful, right? Like every year new chips come out and there's more I think it's called AI on the edge, right? So it's more machine learning can actually happen locally. I think that the cloud is something that it's great that it's there, and it's great that we can outsource work that we don't always want to store locally or have like long history, like store all the data and not and only store like a subset of the data locally or for backups. But what I wish more people would realize with the cloud is that somebody needs to pay for the cloud. And if you have a product that has no subscription cost attached to it and it has a cloud function, then it means that your initial product cost covers the lifetime cloud of your product. And if you expect this product to work for 10 years, then 10 years of cloud cost is included in the price. Then that's something that like is just to think about, because if a product is like a $7 Wi-Fi light bulb with a cloud attached to it, that seems highly suspicious. And then if you think about it that way, then it would be great for manufacturers to also say, hey, this is how long we will support the cloud, for example. But we see that a lot of manufacturers are actually not open about that. They just kind of like skim over it. And then if a cloud would turn off, what happens to these products, right? If I think a product should keep functioning if the cloud is not turned on anymore, if it has to rely on certain functionality for the cloud. But that's not always the case either.
You are preaching to the choir. We believe both in, hey, think about your business model before you launch a cloud-connected device. Communicate that business model, and then also communicate and think about expiration dates for how long you're willing to support a device. And I know, you know, early on in the smart home, I get that people didn't do this, right? Like, I understand that people may not have been thinking this through all the way or might have, you know, it's a little experimental. But 10 years in, I feel like we should have this. And I know in the UK, they're talking about making some of this language a rule, for example, or a law. And I'm for that. Although it could mean that companies put an expiration date on there and, you know, they might just kill it, even though they don't really have to at that point. I don't know. Are there really downsides?
I mean, I think having, at least when you have a law like that, I mean, we have laws like for food that you have to say what's in it, right? So having a product describe what's in it and what it relies on, I think is a good step. And it will also force manufacturers to think about it.
I like it. Yeah. And it levels the playing field on somewhat, you know, you can't sell something that doesn't have that might be super cheap. Because man, the consumers, they go for cheap all the time. That's me too. But I'm like, I'm like, oh no, I know what I'm paying for here. So let's go into Matter. Because this is one of those, I feel like we're at like a sea change moment potentially for the smart home. And for those of y'all who may be unfamiliar, Matter is the new project. It's the new name for Project Connected Home over IP. This is a standard for certain devices that will make them basically communicate easily with one another, no matter what your platform is. So first up, we should ask, hey, is Home Assistant going to support Matter?
Definitely. We always aim to support like all the protocols and APIs possible. Like, I mean, Home Assistant already supports the 1800 different APIs and devices. So Matter will definitely be added to it. And the way Matter is developed with the open source repository should make it very easy to actually integrate, because they will do the hard parts of actually talking the protocol to like the over Wi-Fi, TCP IP or over the radio, and then just Home Assistant can hopefully just plug into that.
Okay, that is a big hope. And what do you think the industry has to gain, and maybe what it even has to lose by adopting Matter broadly?
I think with Matter, it will be very beneficial for home controller devices like Home Assistant or Amazon or Google, because all of a sudden it's very easy. You see a light bulb that speaks Matter, you can control it. It also means with a standard is that we all, you know, it can actually become like a race to the bottom in price-wise, because everybody can make a Matter-compatible light, and that is going to work with a Google or whatever smart home system you have. But it's also great because if you then make nicer-looking lights and you're still Matter-compatible, that's how you can still distinguish yourself. And so we might also see just like certain light manufacturers will be able to make cool stuff and still make it work out of the box. And for example, if you're great at making lights, you don't have to be great at making a smart home hub anymore, right? IKEA needs to make a hub. Philips Hue needs to make a hub. But if they don't want to anymore and they just want to make lights, that's a possibility now. I think the downside of having a standard is that if you want to do something else, you cannot. You're limited to what the standard can do, or else you need to build up all that infrastructure. So for example, don't expect a standard for media players like Sonos or Chromecast or these kind of things, because they just do so many things that are like their unique advantage is actually all the stuff they offer, which is not standardized.
Okay, and that makes sense. Although they could layer that on there. So like, I think if Philips Hue actually does a great job with this, I think. I can control my lights through an Echo or things like that. But if I really want to get fancy with them and create like scenes, I have to download the app. I have to work with that. At the same time, they're also fairly open. Like I used to have, I don't remember the name of the app, but I had an app that would like allow me to do dance parties and tie my Philips Hue to music. And, you know, and that was just an API call on that developer side. So I feel like, I guess as long as you are open both, I guess I think of it northbound, southbound APIs, but people would probably think inside, you know, to another ecosystem and then outside your ecosystem, that feels pretty good.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I really like about Matter, and of course, I mean, we haven't seen the specification yet. They say it's been finalized, but it's not out there. But one of the things mentioned in one of their press releases that interested me a lot was the thing called multi-admin, which normally in like a smart home network like Zigbee or Z-Wave, there's a single controller that is the boss, that like they get all the notifications. In a multi-admin system, it will mean that two systems can be the controller and get the notifications of what happens in the system. And if that's the case, it means that, for example, you could plug in Home Assistant and Amazon and Google and all connect the same lights instead of Google having the Meta network and Amazon wouldn't be able to tap into it or Home Assistant.
I agree. I am very, and I think that is actually, that's how it's been described to me. Again, we'll see. The spec won't be out until about fall. And if you want to see it, you have to join the, now it used to be the Zigbee Alliance. Now it is the Connectivity Standards Alliance and join the Matter working group. So maybe you should get in there. I don't know.
Well, we actually reached out to ask them about like joining, but we haven't heard back from them in the last, it's been a couple of weeks now.
Oh, well, let's ask them right now. Hey,
if you're listening, please respond to our email. Now, I mean, we've been very interested in Matter from the start, and we've also been trying to build the open source project to see if we can already get Home Assistant like, you know, hooked up. But the last time we actually ran the open source project, it didn't work. And they said that there were some incompatible changes made and we had to like wait a month. So, yeah, I think Matter is just so much still under development. And, you know, the PR machine says that, you know, this holiday season we should be able to see products. And I don't know, like there's for something that has no working things publicly yet. I don't know. It seems a bit optimistic.
I think we'll see products from like the big vendors, especially on the controller side. I don't think we're going to see compatible devices like the kind of end nodes, unless you're like Eve and have been building for this for a while. You're not going to see those until 2022. Because like when I talk to lock makers and some of the light bulb companies, they're like, yeah, we're going to launch new products in 2022. But for for now, we're going to update our controllers if we can.
Right. And I mean, it also, I think a lot of these products just rely on like standardized chips created by Silicon Labs and the kind. And, you know, they also have to release their products first, right? So then you can put that in your light bulb.
Indeed. So long. All right. Well, let's talk about the future of the smart home, just because, you know, you've been doing this for a while. I've been doing this for a while. It's not a secret that I've been kind of like, I'm bored by it all right now. I'm a little like, I've automated things. I've set up routines. Meh. So what's exciting to you? What are you looking forward to? What are you building now?
Yeah, I mean, things that I'm excited about is that we've been working, you know, we're the open source home automation platform, and we also work a lot with like makers and do-it-yourself crowd. And there, a lot of people are making their own small devices to hook into their home automation platform, mainly into Home Assistant, but others too. And we've been trying to make it actually easier for people to build stuff and then share it. So one of the things that we launched last year is a tech reader, which is just a simple box where you can put NFC cards on and any card can trigger any routine in your smart home, including like playing music. And this is something people can build themselves. One person was also selling them. But for example, my son, ever since he was 1 year old, you can actually tap the cards and he could play music in our living room. And that's the kind of playful, toyful thing you can do with a smart home, where there's not many products out there that actually do this. And it's not something you could probably mass manufacture because not everybody would be interested in it. But I think that there's definitely people that want this in their home. And I think if we can, you know, we're really trying to build out a maker ecosystem where everybody can easily create stuff for smart homes that just, you know, all works locally and just these kind of playful things.
I like it. And, you know, one of the most common things, and it, okay, I shouldn't say the most common things. We've had multiple requests over the years for some sort of thing, like a screen device that shows people their sports scores in their man caves. I cannot tell you how often the word man cave, it's always next to a Wi-Fi powered device that shows me my sports scores. So I'm curious, have you seen anything like that? Because I've looked at like the DAC boards, I've looked at some options there, but it's hard to get the sports APIs.
Right. Well, I mean, if you want to like hack it all together, with Home Assistant, we actually built something called Home Assistant Cast. And it's for the Google Nest Hub has a screen, it has a touch screen, and you can actually project your Home Assistant UI on it and interact with it. So then you can actually control your lights. You could also see any other data that's in Home Assistant if that was a sports score. But yeah, in the end, there's, if you want to go more the like off-the-shelf route, I don't think there's many. I mean, you almost end up with like a tablet with a browser.
Yeah. And then is that something you want to hang on the wall of your man cave? I don't know. Okay. Well, that's disappointing because, I mean, I'm not a sports person, nor do I have a man cave, but I love the idea of, I thought we would be to a point where normal people could kind of use off-the-shelf parts to, and I don't even want to say hack together. It's basically like, hey, if I tie into this service, I can take this part and tie it to this service, kind of like IFT actually promised to be, but isn't. So I'm a little sad about that, I'll be honest.
Yeah, maybe in the future, if we get, you know, Meta is a good first step to just get at least the data flowing easily accessible by other projects. I think a lot of the times the challenge is, you know, if you're the creator of a screen that can like show anything and have users interact with it, well, then you also need a place to gather the data. And so, you know, Home Assistant, for example, is one of those places to gather the data, but it's such a big job just to maintain all those different integrations. Every data source keeps breaking, changing APIs, like not always the same. It's always like a different one, but we need to keep, you know, all that stuff needs to keep being updated. So if you are a creator of a screen, well, you don't have the money or the effort to actually keep all those data sources up to date. So you only pick a few data sources and then maybe you focus on the American market. So you pick some data sources there. And then I know it always ends up like as a mess because you almost need like a subscription service to have developers just constantly fix that stuff unless you're open source and, you know, rely on volunteers like we are.
Yeah, and that actually brings up a good point because y'all offer a cloud service now. And I'm curious, if you go more towards the mainstream customer, what kind of business models are y'all thinking about? Because I know you're open source, but I mean, it's a lot of work.
Right. Well, actually, our business model right now works. So we have Home Assistant runs completely local. But the problem with a completely local system is that there's two problems. One problem is that if you're away from home, you cannot reach the thing that runs inside your home. And so if you're technical, you can open a port on your router and make a connection. But that's the technical user might set it up. The more mainstream user will actually use Home Assistant Cloud, which is an end-to-end encrypted remote control of your Home Assistant instance. And the second part is that because it's also, again, inside your house, Google or Amazon, if you talk to your voice assistants, can actually send that message that needs to go to your Home Assistant instance. They don't work like that. They can only send it to one space spot on the internet saying, I have a message for a Home Assistant instance. And then our Home Assistant Cloud has to make sure it gets routed to the right Home Assistant instance. So with Home Assistant Cloud, you get Amazon, Google, and remote control and text-to-speech API. It just works. So you don't have to set up anything. All these things can actually be set up by the technical users themselves without paying, which is fine because those users will probably contribute back in another way.
Exactly. Yes. I'm never going to contribute back other than like feedback. But it'd be like, hey, this broke.
Right. The thing is with the business model right now is that, like, you know, Home Assistant has no investors or loans, but we still have 13 people working on it full time.
That's impressive. Wow. All right. Well, Balas, thank you so much for coming on the show this week. I am really excited to have talked to you. I am excited to see possibly a user-friendlier version of Home Assistant out there. And yeah, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And that concludes this week's episode of the Internet of Things podcast. Please join us next Thursday and don't forget to subscribe. And if you can't get enough IoT news, I would love for you to sign up at www.stacyonIoT.com for our weekly IoT newsletter, where we explain all kinds of things that we don't even get to on the show. Once again, thank you for listening, and please subscribe.